It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sometimes it is anyone's guess what candidates for public office would actually do if they're elected. But in the race for Wisconsin governor, voters have been given more than 120 examples of what they can expect. They're all bills that passed the Republican-dominated state legislature, only to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. As Sean Johnson reports, those bills and many more could become law if Republican challenger Tim Michaels wins in November.
Tony Evers vetoed a total of 126 bills in the last two-year session of the legislature. Since Wisconsin became a state in 1848, no governor has vetoed more bills in a single session. Included on this list were bill after bill that would have made changes to Wisconsin election laws, including by adding hurdles to voting absentee. These were top priorities for GOP lawmakers, and at a September campaign rally, Tim Michaels tells Republican voters they'll be priorities for him.
We are going to take those bills that Tony Evers vetoed. We're going to get them right. I'm going to sign them.
It wasn't just election bills that Evers rejected. He vetoed gun bills, including one that would have proclaimed that any federal bans on assault weapons don't apply in Wisconsin. He vetoed bills that would have chipped away at the safety net, like a plan to trim unemployment benefits down from 26 weeks to as little as 14. At the same rally, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss makes reference to all of them.
It's going to happen, and I promise you, when we are here in 1 year with Governor Michaels, every single thing that Governor Evers has vetoed is going to be considered by the legislature, and hopefully all of it becomes law because we are back to being the conservative, revolutionary place that Wisconsin was under Governor Walker.
This riles up Republicans. With one election, by winning this one race for governor, a full-speed-ahead conservative agenda could be theirs. But it also means Democrats see Evers as essential to blocking that agenda. Republican lobbyist Bill McCoshin worked for former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. Even though the former governor had a record of working with both parties, McCoshin said Thompson would brag about the Democratic policies he stopped in order to motivate GOP voters.
It shows the strength of the office and why the office is important. So highlighting that, there's no downside to that, at least in my opinion, and Tommy proved that. You can be out there saying, listen, I stopped all these bad things that you, my base, are against. And that's why you need to fight hard to reelect me.
On the campaign trail, Evers is soft-spoken, low-key. During a recent campaign stop at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, Evers asks student supporters, politely, to get out and vote.
And please vote for yours truly, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm always going to be a Badger. Thank you.
His speech here talks about what he's for, including education funding and legalized marijuana. He doesn't talk about vetoes, but in this crowd, he doesn't have to. People say Evers' veto power is part of the reason they're supporting him. Grant Hall, a sophomore studying computer science and data science, worries about the election bills Republicans would sign without Evers.
And I feel like it'll prevent a large number of Wisconsin voters from being able to go out to the polls and have their voice heard.
Rihanna Mukherjee, a senior at the UW-Madison majoring in political science, says that without Evers, Republicans would have too much control.
I think in a democracy you need balancing voices, and our Republican legislator doesn't balance voices.
In an interview after his speech, Evers says his vetoes reflect his value system, and people know that.
Part of my job going forward, again, the next 4 years will be to be that goalie and prevent bad legislation from becoming law.
And if he's not governor, Evers thinks those bills will be passed and signed as quickly as possible. In the contentious race for governor, it's one issue where Evers and Republicans seem to agree. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now, petflation. It is a thing as prices soar all around us to levels not seen in 40 years. We focus on our pets when budgets are stretched thin. According to the industry publication Pet Age, breaking down federal data, in August and September, petflation accelerated, especially in pet food, and veterinary care. Did you notice? Join in on money-saving tips and caring for pets, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Julia Bates is a board-certified veterinarian in small animal internal medicine at Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. Dr. Bates, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So we're going to work our way through all aspects of having a pet and starting with vet bills, because a national animal advocacy group says dog owners pay roughly $400 for annual routine medical care and prevention. Cat owners pay about $300 each year. How does a vet clinic determine and set service and procedure pricing?
Great question. You know, a lot of it comes down to what they have to pay their providers. I mean, they're, you know, where they get medications and drugs and supplies, their suppliers. And a lot of the suppliers' costs have gone up. You know, they've added surcharges for fuel. You know, so those costs have risen significantly. Wages have gone up, which, you know, it's good. I mean, staff wages need to go up, but wages have gone up, you know, paying for buildings, all of those things play into that and cost. You know, it's a pretty uniform, I would imagine, that costs amongst most clinics are somewhat similar. You're going to have a little bit of variation, but most clinics face the same thing of having, you know, the costs associated with supplies. The harder part is really for the little guys, like the ones that are not corporately owned. So a lot of clinics are being taken over by big corporations. So in those places, they get better pricing, you know, just like pharmacies get better pricing on drugs. But a lot of those are fixed costs, which you just really can't get around, unfortunately.
You hit on something I really wanted to ask you, because some in the vet industry say going to these larger chains, these large chain vet clinics, that they can hold down prices by using their size to leverage lower prices for supplies and you know, and medicines for pets. Are there prices, you know, do you see that? Have you noticed that at all?
That I don't know the answer to, but I know that a lot of the corporates, they're not necessarily owned by veterinarians, so it's very profit driven as opposed to being patient centric.
Vet clinics are labor intensive, as you mentioned. Do clinics increase costs to keep up with the cost of their staff and keeping vet tech salaries and veterinarian salaries competitive in these times when they're trying to keep staff?
And you have to. I mean, right now there is a shortage of staff available for, you know, every clinic that I go to. Everybody is looking for staff. And, you know, they're always asking me, oh, do you know anybody who's looking? Because everybody is short staffed right now. And, you know, that adds to the stress of everything. But yeah, I mean, you know, techs deserve to be paid more. But it does increase the cost of veterinary care.
If a pet owner is struggling to pay for vet care or for an upcoming procedure, what would you recommend? What are their options?
That's a great question. You know, pet insurance is something to consider. The tough part about pet insurance is that once you have a problem diagnosed, it's too late. You know, the pet insurance isn't going to cover that. Mm-hmm. So it's best to think about that earlier. You know, another option would be to put aside, you know, money every month into a savings account, you know, to save that money for pet care. And, you know, but it helps, the insurance would be something to consider, but again, think about it early. And the younger the pet is when you purchase the insurance, obviously the more affordable it is.
Do clinics typically give out their price menu for services like exams and vaccines and blood work if they're asked to do it? How does that transparency work?
But clinics are happy, you know, at least the clinics that I've been in, they're always happy that if you call, they will tell you, you know, what the costs are. But to, you know, unlike a restaurant, it's not posted on the door. Mm-hmm. And the hardest part is if someone is asking for something, if you're not asking for the right thing, that you may it's hard to know what you need. If it's just vaccines, that's easy, right? Oh, what does it cost to get a rabies vaccine? Oh, it's $35, or plus you need an exam, which is, you know, 60 or whatever it costs. But if it's something, you know, more advanced or like some sort of surgery, that may be more difficult to predict unless it's a routine thing like a spay or a neuter.
Right, because when your pet needs a pricier procedure, it's not like you want to shop around for the clinic that will provide the best value, because what if that clinic requires their own set of x-rays or their own set of lab work? You know, do you have insights on when you want to get comparisons and yet you want to still stay with your doctor and your veterinarian?
I think one of the best things that you can do is just be honest, you know, and people are understandably, you know, nervous to say, oh my gosh, I can't really afford that. But I think if people can have that conversation with their vet, you know, their vet is going to try to advocate for them. So, and do the best they can. But if as a veterinarian, you know what you're working with, it's easier to make recommendations and be able to say, hey, okay, this is the optimum thing, but, and you need to know that this is the optimum thing, but here are some other things that we can do that don't cost as much. And as long as you're making an informed decision, it's a reasonable one.
Wisconsin veterinarian Julia Bates is here on how to think about pet care in difficult financial times. Join in with ideas on how you have saved on pet care costs, questions you have about changes you made in what you buy for your pet. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we discuss petflation, pet owners can expect to spend more on all sorts of pet products and services, food, treats, toys, vet care bills, as we've been talking about. Join in on managing rising costs with inflation and pets. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have veterinarian Julia Bates, who stays with us. So, Julia, you have said that pet meds and prescriptions purchased through a vet clinic are typically more expensive. Why is that?
It's because the big pharmacies, I mean, they can get much better pricing just because of their size and volume. But there are some ways to combat that and support your local veterinarian as well. There are online pet pharmacies. A lot of clinics have online pet pharmacies in which the costs are similar to what you can get from other online pharmacies like Chewy.com or, you know, 1-800-PetMeds. But you can support your local clinic as well and get better pricing. I mean, what goes into pricing in the clinics too is that medication has to sit on the shelf. And so medications expire, you know, and so all of those things, the cost that you buy it for, plus having to shelve it and monitor it and inventory it and count it all out, I mean, all of that, you know, costs money and adds up. But I would recommend looking and asking your vet if they have an online pharmacy and try to support that.
Terry from Nina called, couldn't stay with us. And Terry wants to know, Dr. Bates, if automatic Lyme disease tests are worth the cost. Terry recently paid a lot for the test and wants to know if it was worth the cost.
An automatic Lyme disease. I wonder if he's talking about screening tests. So oftentimes there's something called a 40X, which tests for tick-borne diseases, which Lyme is one of them. And so as a screening test, it helps us evaluate whether or not there have been exposure to ticks, which then can expose to other significant diseases. So from that perspective, from a preventative type stance, yes. But if the pet is otherwise doing well, would it be unreasonable to request to put that off until a later time? You know, sure. Mm-hmm. There's no right or wrong. It's making an informed decision. And I think the more that you talk to your veterinarian about your concerns and financial concerns, the better they can help you make informed decisions.
What about putting off flea and tick meds during winter months as a way to save? What should people think about flea and tick control?
Good question. So when the ground is frozen, you know, tick medications are not needed as much. The season for ticks is getting longer and longer. Like right now, it is height of tick season. You know, and because the weather and climate is changing, I mean, we're seeing more ticks in Wisconsin, like types of ticks that we didn't see before. And so that is increasing the risk of tick-borne diseases. And I can tell you preventing them is much less expensive than treating for them in some cases. Like there's a, like one of the diseases that we see a lot in Wisconsin is called leptospirosis, and it is a bacteria that is everywhere. And we see it more in the fall and in the spring. And it can be life-threatening and it can be really expensive to treat, whereas a $35 vaccine, you know, can help prevent it.
Prevention going a long way there. Talking about ways pet owners can save money as inflation increases, Dr. Julia Bates is a Madison-based veterinarian, board certified in small animal internal medicine. You can join in money-saving tips, questions you've made, changes to your pet care in these times, 800-642-1234. Victor in Amherst has a question. Victor, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I do something that's a little bit maybe counterintuitive, and I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but I have an older dog. He's like 13 and a half, actually a little older than that now, but I the counterintuitive part is that I buy really expensive dog food that's really, really good. It's grain-free, and then I supplement some raw food, but less of that. And then I run him. He's 13 and a half, and he's still going on 10, 12, 13, you know, half marathon runs with me, just
wow.
Training runs. And he's still doing that. And it's just, you know, amazing. And it keeps him out of the vet, I think, office. You know, he goes in for regular checkups, and they're always amazed. So his name is Marley.
What breed is Marley, Victor?
I think, you know, I need to get one of those Embark things, DNA test, but I think he's a pointador.
Okay.
Yeah, so he doesn't have that classic, you know, hip dysplasia prone, you know, physiology, I guess. So.
Well, thank you for describing him. Dr. Bates, you know, a grain-free dog food and really running the dog. What are your insights there?
Well, one, congratulations on Marley having such a wonderful, long-lived life. We have to be really careful with grain-free diets. I mean, we're unfortunately seeing a lot of disease associated with them, especially grain-free diets that contain peas and lentils. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing dogs develop significant heart disease. So it's really important to talk to your vet about the food that you've gotten, and not all dogs it's going to happen to. And I'm really happy that Marley hasn't had any problems. And he mentioned an expensive food. I would say that really that is somewhere people can save money as well is, you know, just because it's the most expensive food doesn't make it the best. I've always said to my clients that the food that's best for your dog is the one that they do the best on. And I was really happy when a paper came out that supported what I had been saying. And, you know, it's not necessarily feeding a food like Old Roy, but, you know, my dogs, you know, eat Purina and they do very well on it. I personally have tried some of the more expensive diets and my dogs got really gassy and it just was not a nice place to be. So they do much better on what some people might consider a low grade food. But I think it's, you know, I think it's a very good food. And, you know, so that might be another way to save some money as well.
Is there anything we should watch out for, though, in terms of fillers or other ingredients that maybe some dogs won't do well with?
Good question. You know, there's a lot of owners believe that their dogs are allergic to chicken, which is the protein that most foods are based off of. But the reason those foods are based, their primary ingredient is chicken, is it tends to be the least allergenic. Hmm. And that's why that protein is selected. You know, it's about fillers. Good question. I'm not really a nutritionist, so it's hard to say. I do recommend avoiding diets with peas and lentils, though, because we do know that that those can potentially lead to other problems down the road.
We only have a few seconds left, but doggy daycare costs can be really high for pet owners. Are there any substitutes for taking your dog to daycare?
You know, some people are really lucky and can take their dog to work or, you know, or maybe coming home for lunch, you know, saving money by coming home from lunch and not eating out and taking your dog for a walk, or maybe having someone come in and walk your dog through the day can, you know, be less expensive as well.
Dr. Bates, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Julia Bates is with Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a parent's business.
Running a family business can instill pride and a valuable work ethic that circulates through the household. Wisconsin writer Nancy Jorgensen shares a story about growing up around her father's printing business and its lasting impact on future generations of the family.
My dad's work shirts, button-down, short-sleeved, white or blue, smelled like ink. The scent radiated, faint each morning when he wore a clean one, heavy in the evenings after a day in the shop. When ink dries, it releases the scent of aldehydes, ketones, and carboxylic acids. To me, it was the aroma of security, pride, and hard work. My dad birthed his offset printing company the same year I was born, in 1954, when paper companies and print shops flourished in Wisconsin. During the day, he ran jobs in another printer's shop, and in the evenings, he operated his own press. He worked from our basement, where paper and color became brochures, pamphlets, and books. While my mother fed and tended to me, he nurtured his other baby. Like twins, the business and I grew together. Within a few years, my dad quit his day job and bought more presses, cameras, a cutter, folder, stitcher, and drill. He mortgaged a building and created a press room, darkroom, bindery, and office. He stocked paper, glue, and ink. An entrepreneur, he grew a business alongside his family, and soon I had a brother and sister. The business sent my siblings and me to college, and in the summer between semesters, I worked in the bindery. My fingers studied the sensations of gloss, matte, and silk. My arms weighed the difference between a newspaper and the sheets of a magazine. As ideas and information became leaflets and publications, I inhaled the chemicals straight from their ink-soaked pages. My dad chose a business for the future, a legacy for our family, a product that would always be in demand. Didn't every college need a course brochure? Didn't every auction need a catalog? Didn't every city need a wall calendar? He paid a fair wage to salesmen, pressmen, cameramen, and secretaries, and he carved room in the budget for donations to local schools, to the Park and Recreation Department, to the Shainstadt sisters in their long black habits who needed materials for their retreats. My dad died before the collapse of Wisconsin's printing industry. Confident, he left my brother a profitable legacy. But when colleges and auctions and city governments moved information online and print shops around the state folded, my brother said, Dad would want me to face reality and make tough choices. My grandson Stanley, 2.5 years of age, learns songs from YouTube. He pinches a screen to watch a favorite show. He shouts at the alarm on my phone, Hey Google, stop! He is a child of Wi-Fi, of FaceTime, of Instagram, of Twitter, and his parents buy more broadband than number 2 pencils, more 4G than spiral notebooks. But when Stanley is tired, he offers me his favorite book. Grandma, read? He strokes the fur on a page about animals. He screams siren sounds at a page about fire trucks. He sniffs the image of a rose on a page about flowers. When Stanley is older, I will show him my drawer full of his great-grandpa's work. Covers and insides, shiny and black, or clean and white, or textured and variegated. Relics of a not-so-long-ago time and a man who made an imprint.
That was writer and Waukesha native Nancy Jorgensen. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, the Department of Natural Resources is making efforts to save a disappearing songbird, the Connecticut warbler. This is the male's call. That's courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The DNR announced recently it's partnering with state and national groups to protect the at-risk Connecticut warbler, which has a gray hood, a yellow belly, and olive back. Its numbers have plunged more severely than expected. Join in, 800-642-1234. Craig Thompson is Program Integration Chief for the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Craig, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to join you.
Well, explain the emergency actions and what is happening with the at-risk Connecticut warbler.
Well, we're really quite distressed and dismayed by the fact that Connecticut warblers have declined almost 80% in Wisconsin in the last 20 years. Now, this is a species that has its core population, more than 90% of its population, actually up in Canada. But it's still one of our breeding birds, and we have been tracking it through our breeding bird atlas efforts. And what happened is we went out and surveyed again for the second iteration of the breeding bird atlas, and we said, oh my gosh, these birds are just about gone. And so we did a more intensive survey in 2021 and 2022, and turns out that we have only what remain three breeding pair that are left in the state. That's it, which is again about an 80% decline. And that is puzzling because for the most part, the habitat for this bird is generally intact. And so that points to perhaps other things that are going on within this bird's hemispheric range. Now, this is considered to be a long distance migrant, and this bird flies annually about 5,000 miles one way to winter in central South America. And so there are concerns about what's going on in the wintering grounds down there. And as you had mentioned in the introduction, we now have a multi-partner international effort underway to try to understand what's happening to this bird with the intent to intervene before it completely disappears.
Why do the warblers find habitat in the northwestern part of our state? What is good about the habitat there?
Well, so this bird is associated with two basic types of habitat, Kate. There, it's more traditional breeding habitat are spruce bogs and tamarack bogs that are found in central and northern Wisconsin, and of course throughout boreal Canada, which stretches from eastern Canada to western Canada. In this particular instance, the birds in Wisconsin are also nesting in older stands of jack pine, which is a drier upland habitat. And there just isn't a lot of that habitat left anymore in terms of its quality. So they're a little persnickety about where they nest. And what we're doing now is we're going in and finding areas where we believe that the structure, the height of the trees, the association of the trees and density of the trees is going to be attractive to the birds if we can clean out the understory. So we're making some vegetative modifications to their habitat in order to try to attract more warblers to northwest Wisconsin to supplement the three breeding pair that we have there now.
Are these breeding pairs that you know, are they tagged in some way? Are you following them?
You know what we're not following them, but we have documented them. So okay. No, we're not pursuing that level of intervention, which is actually getting in and capturing the birds and tagging them to be able to track them. This is a pretty precarious state of affairs for a species like this. When you're down to three breeding pair, you have to be really careful about what happens in terms of trying to hang on to those birds. And so, you know, we really are really even discouraging people from going out and looking for them. We just don't want that level of disturbance. What we need to do is work with partners to understand what's driving these declines and then devise appropriate strategies to respond in an effort to try to recover the population. So for right now, we're monitoring the birds and we're modifying and we hope improving habitat adjacent to this small breeding population to try to draw in more birds. And time will tell if our efforts are successful. We'll be out there monitoring again next year and fingers crossed that we'll find more than three breeding pair.
The Cornell Lab describes them as infamously hard to find. How confident are you that these surveys are accurately representing the warblers' whereabouts and how many there are?
We have really, Cornell is right, they're a skulker, as we refer to them. That means they're very secretive, and that's by design. They're a ground-dwelling warbler, so they feed on the ground, they walk on the ground, they breed on the ground. They basically don't want to be out in the open, hardly at all. On occasion, you can see one singing from a perch, but for the most part, this is a very cryptic, secretive species. However, they have a very distinctive and beautiful song, and we have biologists that are very good and very tuned into listening for this bird in the right habitats. And so we're confident that the situation that we have characterized as an 80% decline is in fact accurate. And we will continue to fan out across forest and field to find these species when we have the resources to do so. And of course, in this particular instance, we're quite concerned, as we had mentioned, about this bird. And so this is an all hands on deck exercise for this bird. And this species, Kate, is really emblematic of broader bird declines across North America in general. The State of the Birds report just came out for North American species, and it's quite sobering. We're confronting broad declines in a host of species, grassland birds, aerial insectivores like swallows and swifts, and of course, long distance migrants like the Connecticut warbler and others of its ilk, which migrate to Central and South America every year. So we have some challenges cut out for us in order to try to save not only Wisconsin's native bird species, but bird species across North America as well. And the Connecticut warbler is emblematic of that situation and our efforts to respond.
As you say, talk about these broader bird declines. This morning, I was scrolling through the red list of threatened species, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and their red list. And I was specifically looking at what they were going to say about the Connecticut warbler. But something that really struck me is that with all of these species of warblers, some are stable, some are increasing, some are decreasing. It was really on the red list, this mixed bag. So among the dozens of species of warblers out there, why are some faring better and some faring worse?
It depends on the species. So typically, there are a small group of warblers that winter in the southern United States, species like palm warblers, pine warblers, yellow-rumped warblers. And those birds, you know, they're not under the same pressures. They're not flying as far. There's more habitat available to them. They're tougher because they can survive some of these cold snaps, even down south. Whereas the longer distance migrants like Kentucky warblers, worm-eating warblers, cerulean warblers and such, gosh, they're flying all the way to Central and South America every year. And there are all kinds of things going on in the wintering ground. So, for instance, cerulean warblers is a species that nests in southern Wisconsin. And it winters in the Andes of northern South America. And it just happens to winter at the same altitude that is ideal for growing coffee. So what we're seeing is wholesale forest removal where this bird spends the winter and replacement of those native forests in Colombia and Ecuador and Peru with sun coffee plantations. And that just does not provide suitable habitat for that bird or any of the resident species that are found in those countries. And so we're bumping up against these significant hurdles associated with trying to maintain high quality breeding grounds and trying to maintain high quality wintering grounds thousands of miles to the south. So when we devise conservation strategies for these long distance migrants, they have to be hemispheric in scope. takes a lot of resources, a lot of collaboration across continents, and that proves to be a very challenging endeavor. But we're giving it our best shot.
Craig Thompson, Program Integration Chief for the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program, with us learning about efforts to save the Connecticut warbler, which is one of the rarest of songbirds. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a rescue plan for Connecticut warblers that have decreased dramatically across their range. The DNR's summer survey finding only three nesting pairs in the core breeding area in northwestern Wisconsin. Join in on the health and stability of warblers, other migrating songbirds, 800-642-1234. Craig Thompson is Program Integration Chief for the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program and stays with us. Let's go to Bruce now in Green Bay. Bruce, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Well, I guess had a question or statement. I mean, there's three mating pairs, so that means six birds, and we're at, 80% less than we had last time the census was taken. So we've got six birds. That means that's 20%. So 5 times 20 means there would be 30 birds. We're looking at trying to get the population back up to. And I guess, I enjoy wildlife. I enjoy the outdoors. Feed birds myself and so on. But it seems like maybe we're putting a lot of effort, a lot of funds towards something that maybe we've got a solution in search of a problem, and are there not other environmental problems maybe our funds could be better used for?
Bruce, thank you. Yes, mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Bruce, doing the math there, is this worth it, Craig?
Well, Bruce raises a good point, and we always bump up against this notion of, well, where are our dollars most effectively spent, given that we have limited resources in terms of time and funds typically to deal with any of these species. But the Natural Heritage Conservation Program, in a broader sense, DNR, is committed to trying to retain all of our native species. And so we believe that we still have an opportunity to recover this bird. And the interventions we're doing in terms of habitat modifications are really not that expensive and could pay big dividends if we actually can create, if we can grow a larger population over a shorter period of time. And so I appreciate the comment. I think being a wise steward of our funds is always appropriate, and it's always front and center with us, but we believe that this is a worthwhile investment. This is a species that is integral to Wisconsin. We've had them here forever, and we simply don't want to lose them, and we're committed to trying to prevent that from happening. So we believe that this is an appropriate level of response for us in order to try to retain one of Wisconsin's native and enigmatic birds.
Are there, Craig, notable success stories with similar interventions and responses with birds in the past?
Oh, gosh, yes. So, trumpeter swans were tanking, and they have come back, and they're abundant across the landscape. And that was due to intensive recovery efforts, which required a lot of time and a lot of funding. Whooping cranes are another example of birds that were teetering on the brink. They're not fully recovered, but they're more abundant than they used to be. Another example, Kate, is the Kirtland's warbler, which was a federally endangered species due to a strong response from the conservation community, including habitat manipulation and partnerships, which were committed to recovering the bird over the long haul. We now have delisted that species, and so that's been an entirely successful recovery effort. So we have a number of examples, and there are more. We have a number of examples where, when we have the information, when we really understand what's driving these population declines, we can respond in an appropriate and strategic way in order to stem the bleeding, as it were, and help to recover these birds. And that's our intent in this instance too. We really are fully committed to trying to maintain a breeding population of Connecticut warblers in Wisconsin, and we hope we'll be successful. Time will tell.
Can we focus a moment on climate change in Wisconsin? The Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impact says our state has warmed by 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1950, and that precipitation in our state is up 17% over the same period. How is the changing climate here in Wisconsin affecting birds?
Well, there are. It's a great question, and we're still in the process of trying to understand that. Things are changing so rapidly in terms of climate change, and the responses of plant communities, the responses of insects, and by extension, the responses of birds. One example would be, you talk about increased precipitation. For the, not this past year, but for previous springs, we have had some very cold and snowy Aprils. So what we're seeing is a situation where the weather begins to moderate in March, and then birds begin to come back. And then all of a sudden in April, things seize up. We had that for 3 Aprils in a row, and I think it was 2018, 19, and 20. And not only did temperatures plunge, but we got accumulating persistent snow. And that was at a time when a lot of birds had come back, and they simply could not find the food resources to sustain themselves. So we had widespread bird mortality associated with those unusual, atypical late spring storms, which for a while appeared to be becoming the norm, and they really took a hit on birds. That may be, it's hard to point to any weather event or any series of weather events and say that that is due to climate change. But what we're seeing are these extremes, extreme heat, extreme precipitation, extreme cold, and so on, that are more frequent than they used to be. And that takes a toll on everything. And the bottom line is, if weather is affecting insects in a negative way, it's going to affect birds as well, because insects are the little things, according to a former wonderful biologist by the name of E.O. Wilson at Harvard University. He said, insects are the little things that run the world, and birds are entirely dependent on insects in terms of being able to sustain not only their ability to reproduce, but their ability to migrate as well. And so to the extent that weather is having an impact on insects, and of course we're seeing broad declines in insect biomass across North America now, and we're seeing declines in association with a lot of those species that feed very heavily, particularly on flying insects, swallows, swifts, and whippoorwills and such. So these things go part and parcel, and climate change is, we already have lots of challenges for birds. Climate change is another complicated overlay that we're trying to understand and that we hope we'll be able to respond to. But it's really a work in progress in that regard.
We only have a few moments left, but as I hear the urgency in your voice, it makes me wonder, what can we do? What can we do to protect birds and things we can do at home?
So 4 things very quickly, Kate. First, plant native vegetation. As I had indicated, insects are just the basis of the food chain for everything, all of our wildlife. So to the extent that native vegetation is in your yard, trees, shrubs, and forbs, that's going to help. If you have windows that are killing birds, consider window treatments. And there are a variety of things that you can do to make your windows less lethal to birds, because windows are the number 2 killer of birds, with perhaps 1 billion birds a year dying due to window strikes. Keep outdoor cats indoors. Mm-hmm. Cats are efficient predators, but they are actually safer and healthier indoors. And then finally, consider drinking shade-grown coffee. It's the kind of coffee that birds in the winter, our cerulean warblers, our Kentucky warblers, and such, winter in shade-grown plantations in Central and South America. And so you can start every morning with a cup of conservation.
Craig, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Appreciate your interest in this topic. Thank you.
Craig Thompson, Program Integration Chief for the Department of Natural Resources Natural Heritage Conservation Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.